Anchored is a production of the Classic Learning Test. Based in Annapolis, Maryland, reconnecting knowledge and virtue through meaningful assessments. Visit us at cltexam.com/get-started.
Welcome back to the Anchored Podcast, the official podcast of the Classic Learning Test. My name is Soren Schwab, VP of Partnerships here at CLT, and today we are joined by Dr. Francis Hsu. Dr. Hsu is the Benedictine Karwa Professor of Mathematics at Harvey Mudd College and a former president of the Mathematical Association of America. In 2013, he received the HIMO Award, a nationwide teaching prize for college math faculty. And in 2018, he won the Halmosh Fort Writing Award. His work has been featured in Quanta Magazine, Wired, and the New York Times. His book, Mathematics for Human Flourishing, winner of the 2021 Euler Book Prize, offers an inclusive vision of what math is, who it's for, and why anyone should learn it. Dr. Hsu, I'm so excited for this conversation. Thanks for being on.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, we haven't talked about math nearly enough yet on the Anchored Podcast. So I'm really, really excited that we get to do that. But as you may know, we like to start off the Anchored Podcast by talking about our guest's own educational journey. So talk to us a little bit about growing up. Did you attend public school, private school? Did you love education? Were you a late bloomer?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a small town in South Texas, and my parents were, felt that the education at a private Catholic parochial school would be better than the public school system. So I went to for grades 1 through 5, went to a small parochial school. And then at age in grade 6, entered the public school system. I guess it was public all the way through the end of high school.
So do you have kind of a specific moment that you can recall where when you fell in love with mathematics, or were you always a quote unquote math guy?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was fortunate to have people in my life, including my parents, who stressed the value in education and got me interested in learning and reading. And so I guess my love for math maybe grew, but there are some specific moments I remember thinking, wow, this is really cool, right? Like, I think if a friend, when I was a kid, one of my parents' friends came over to the house and challenged me, you know, to add up the numbers from 1 to 100. In my head. And of course, I didn't have any idea how to do this. I 1 + 2 + 3, you know, it would take me forever to do that, right? And so he said, no, let me show you a simpler way. And so what he said was, you know, think about lining up all the numbers in a row. So just to make this simpler, let's talk about just adding numbers 1 to 10. Okay, so how would you do this in a way that was maybe a little more efficient than just adding the numbers up? Well, if you line up the numbers 1 to 10 in a row, you could imagine grabbing the first thing and the last thing on that list. That's 1 and 10, and they add up to 11, right? Then move in on from the ends. So if you grab the second thing and the second to the last thing, that's 2 and 9, they add up to 11. 3 and 8 add up to 11. 4 and 7 add up to 11. So if you work your way in, grabbing things from the end all the way to the middle, you realize there's 5 pairs of things add up to 11. So 5 times 11 is 55. And suddenly you suddenly answer this question that seemed hard in a much simpler way by taking advantage of structure, taking advantage of the symmetry of the situation. And so, you know, with 1 to 100, it's very similar. Like if you think, imagine them all lined up in a row, you have pairs of things counting from both ends. You know, the first and last thing add up to 101, that's 1 and 100. And then the second and the second last thing add up to 101, third and third from last add up to 101. And there's 50 pairs of things that add up to 101. And 50 times 101, you can actually do in your head, it's 5,050, right? So that was like, whoa, mind blown, right? Like amazing. And I think for me, that was a memorable experience of mathematical beauty, right? The just somehow you see something and you're like, and it suddenly gave you a much nicer way of doing the problem.
I think you just blew a lot of our listeners' minds. That is absolutely fascinating. Well, let's cut to the chase here, right? Because a lot of people don't like math, right? They didn't have that kind of aha moment. And full disclosure, I always thought of myself as not a math guy. I think reading your book changed my mind a little bit. Maybe I just didn't have the right teachers or the right approach to math. But why do you think so many students hate math or dislike math or just look at themselves as just, I'm not a math person?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's probably plenty of reasons, but I think a big reason is that people often equate doing math with being a human calculator. And so when they say I'm not a math person, they're saying I'm not a human calculator. And of course, none of us really want to be a human calculator. Like, we have calculators that can calculate things faster than we can, right? So part of the, I think, challenge in teaching and learning mathematics is to see mathematics as thinking, learning to grow in the way that we think and reason, and experiencing wonder and joy when we do that. I think that's often what's missing from many of our math experiences. And so, of course, you're going to think math is dull and boring if it comes across as a lot of plain memorization without understanding.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And I remember I think it was a lecture that you gave at one point where you talked about kind of the math achievement, and you know that some students, you know, unless they are, you know, like the math genius, math is not for them. It's like, you know, unless you're the next Beethoven, you know, music is not for you. Do you feel like there is sometimes also that pressure, you know, if you don't quote unquote succeed based on some standards right away, then maybe it's just not for you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think we, you know, often have this idea that the end goal of math, but many other subjects, is simply achievement. And when you see, if you think that's all math is, then of course you find it easy to label yourself and categorize yourself. And of course, in my time as a professor, I've actually seen many examples of students who are late bloomers, right? Who come to math and without high levels of achievement, and see its wonder, beauty, and are fascinated by it, and then, you know, grow by leaps and bounds in their math education. And so we should never feel the pressure to discount ourselves based on achievement, because, you know, we're going to come in, everyone's going to come in with different kinds of backgrounds. And of course, math isn't just one-dimensional. We tend to think of it as one-dimensional. We're tempted to think of it as like, okay, well, measure everybody according to one virtue, or, you know, or one particular thing, right? Being fast, for instance, is often seen as a sign of mathematical ability, when in fact that's not at all. Like, you know, at the advanced levels, how fast you are isn't really a thing. Like it is at sometimes in elementary schools. And of course, I get it. I get it that teachers want to teach students to have automatic skills, right? But we have to find a way of doing that in a way that doesn't equate being good at math with being fast at math. So that's just one example of a way we tend to make math one-dimensional, rather than seeing there's a whole number of different virtues that we're building in our students.
Well, that's a perfect transition. Let's talk about that a little, because you use the word virtue, right? And of course, as you know, our listeners, many of them are, you know, proponents of liberal arts or classical education. We talk a lot about virtue. We talk a lot about human flourishing as the end of a successful education. Your book is titled Mathematics for Human Flourishing. And when I saw that title, I mean, at first, well, those two go together, right? As the ignorant, not math person. So I guess what prompted you to write the book and think of math kind of in terms of a vehicle for human flourishing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the main impetus for the book and the original speech from which the book was based was trying to get at the question of why it is that people who enjoy mathematics see it one way and everybody else sees it another way. You know, if you talk to anybody who does math for a living or who enjoys doing math, they often talk about math in almost spiritual terms, right? It's like, whoa, this is beautiful, this is elegant, it's wondrous. There's the way that people are captivated by a problem, and you know, when by a mystery, right? Just like you're captivated by a mystery, you want to find out the resolution to the mystery, right? And yet the experiences people have in the math classroom are ones of anxiety or boredom. I wanted to get at that. What is it that makes those experiences so different? And you know, when you think about why anybody does anything, like think of, I'll invite all the listeners here to think about one hobby that you have and why you're captivated by that hobby. What basic human desire does it fulfill, right? If you think like, you know, I enjoy running, and running is, you know, one of the things I like about it is that I feel at one with nature, right? I experience beauty, right? These are all basic human desires, like to experience beauty, right? And so, you know, the book is basically centered around basic human desires that everybody has, like a desire for beauty or truth or community or for freedom. These are basic human desires, and math can meet these desires. And how does it meet these desires? That's the connection between mathematics and being human. And of course, human flourishing is the central theme of that organizes the book. Like, how does math contribute to human flourishing? That, to me, I think is the vision of what a math education should do. Should help people flourish, live their lives better and well, in a way that is more than just for career success or to solve some great problem. It really should open up your mind to see the world differently. And that's the goal of a general, you know, education, a great education, a classical education would do that. You're often thinking about the good, the true, and the beautiful, right? And so how does math contribute to that? I wanted to answer that question. So in many ways, the book is an argument for math as one of the classical liberal arts, right? It's not just something that you do in order to advance yourself or advance society.
Well, and it's fascinating. I told you before we started recording that the way math was always presented to me, and I think, you know, as a young student, we ask a lot of why questions, right? I mean, why do we do that? You know, is it going to be on the test? And what was always answered to me was, well, math, you're going to need it. It was always the practicality and the utility. And I don't know, maybe because I was a little bit of a smarty pants, but I was like, well, no, I won't. You know, I don't know if I'm going to need that. It was never presented to me as you presented in this book. And so I urge all of our listeners to read the book, because I think it changes really the way you view mathematics. And I love one of your quotations: the proper practice of mathematics cultivates virtues that help people flourish. And again, we use that language a lot when we talk about, you know, philosophy and literature and history and what kind of sets the classical liberal arts apart. And at CLG, we are big proponents of classical liberal arts education. But when we go to conferences or we hear talks, oftentimes those subjects, right, it's more humanities centered. And so talk to us a little bit about the role that math plays in a robust liberal arts or in a classical education.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think you know, we don't often think about math as connected to virtue formation, but you know, I'm thinking of a virtue in a much broader sense than potentially, you know, in just the strict Aristotelian tradition. But you know, for instance, virtues, I think of virtues as a certain excellences of character that lead to excellence of conduct. So there's a being aspect, there's a doing aspect. And, you know, the being aspect is, so if it, for instance, a virtue that's built by great math education is the virtue of being creative. Of course, it's built by, you know, the study of other things as well. But in math, it's a certain kind of creativity that's built. And so being creative is both a disposition, it's a character quality, but it's also something you do, right? You, if you're a creative person, it leads to a certain conduct of approaching every problem with a certain creativity, right? Another one is persistence in problem solving. that is built by Great Math Education. Another one is a disposition to beauty and seeing beauty in unexpected places, right? These are all things that are built in unique ways by a great math education, and they serve you well right now. It's not like you're going to need to know it later, which may not even be true, right? Many of the subjects you teach in especially late in high school, you know, calculus, most students will never use calculus even in their lives. Most students will never, that's not to say it's not important. One of the things, the reason it's important is you begin to behold the power of mathematical ideas to solve problems in especially interesting or elegant ways, right? A calculus class should be captivating in that way. It should be like, whoa, the triumph of the human imagination to solve problems that seem really complicated. That's one of the lessons I hope my students come away with when they take a calculus course. It's not because you're going to need to know it later, which for many of my students, they're not going to use calculus in their daily lives at all. But do I want them to see the power of it and the beauty of it? Yeah, sure. Do I want them to be able to reason? Yes. And these are the things that will serve you well no matter what profession you go into.
I think every educator would say yes to all of these, but maybe not necessarily see math as the means to get there.
The vehicle
to get there. And so
maybe a way to think about this then is like, you know, is the analogy to music, right? Like, do we need music in our lives? Well, I guess you could get through life without necessarily needing to know music, right? But doesn't music powerfully change our experiences and help us to enjoy life? Yeah. I mean, even if you're never going to be Beethoven or Beyonce, right? Like, even if you're never going to perform music at the highest levels, the appreciation of music enriches our lives in ways that I would say math does as well, right? Like to look at a pattern and take advantage of its structure and see like, oh, there's actually a simpler way of doing this and appreciate why that's beautiful. That's something that every human being deserves to at least encounter, right? And so how do we do that? That's the real question of math education.
And you talk about the mathematician in terms of an explorer, and I love that. In classical education, we talk a lot about instilling this wonder and curiosity and joy for learning. And you say that math again can contribute to that. So you touched on it a little bit, but can you maybe elaborate a little bit on kind of the cultivation of imagination and creativity through mathematics?
Yeah. You know, so in many of the humanities, often you are discussing ideas. And why do you do that? Because you want to explore the ideas. You know, you get at the ideas from asking interesting questions or good questions. And then people discuss these ideas because there's something to explore. Well, in similar ways, a great math experience should be like that, right? It shouldn't just be plug and chug. It should be, oh, how do we really understand this idea? Or how do I learn to ask great questions of the thing that I'm learning, right? So, you know, if you're thinking about the area of a triangle or whatever it is, you know, in geometry, you know, often that's just presented, here's a formula, let's learn how to plug and chug things, right? Without any real sense of the wonder of geometry, right? Like, so maybe, you know, more interesting exploratory question instead of plug and chug is to construct a triangle that has particular properties, right? And give students a chance to explore. So maybe it is construct a triangle whose area is, let me think of an example. So here's a question, like how large an area do you need to, here's an interesting question. So take a region of the plane, some region, whatever, and imagine taking a needle of one unit, you know, just 1 inch long. Okay. And here's a question. How much area do you need in order to turn the needle around 360 degrees? Right. Now, of course, you could put a needle in a circle, in a disc whose diameter is one unit, and that would be certainly possible to turn a needle around. But you could also put a needle inside something much smaller than a circle and still be able to move the needle around. But what's the smallest area you need to do that? So there's a question, exploratory question. And of course, if you're thinking about this, what do you mean you could do this in something smaller than a disc? You could do it in, you could imagine a star-like object where you sort of push the needle back and forth and turn it around in a much smaller area than a circle. That's an exploratory problem. That's an interesting problem that is not just plug and chug. It actually forces you to grapple with what an area is. These are the kinds of things that make math interesting and enchanting.
Well, I'm thinking back to an experience that I had the first time I went to Barcelona, and I walked into the Sagrada Familia and I saw Gaudi's work. And it was just absolutely mind-blowing, right? But this is like math at work, right? When you look at this and how it's designed, and when you think about your geometry.
Yeah.
But again, I growing up, I just never made these connections. I never looked at the world around me. I don't think I had that foundation of kind of the purpose of mathematics beyond its utility. And so I think your chapter on especially on beauty, I think it really touched me and it resonated with me. And if you can share this quick story with our reader, but in your chapter on beauty, you talk about one of the gen ed classes that you had to take, and it happened to be I think it was architecture appreciation. And that really kind of changed the way you looked at something. And I kind of want that experience for our audience as well, as they maybe, you know, kind of rethink their appreciation for math. So can you share that quick story about your gen ed class?
So I had to take an art class of some kind in college. And I just sort of searched around in the catalog for stuff, you know, and that would fulfill this requirement. I stumbled across this architecture class, architecture appreciation. You know, basically, you know, it was just like, okay, I'll take this, probably have no interest, whatever, but at least we'll sit there and look at pictures of beautiful buildings. But you know what? We sat there and looked at these beautiful buildings, and I was like amazed, like, when the professor was talking about form and function and asking us to think differently about these buildings, like, why would you build a building with certain angles or with certain, you know, designs, you know, with lots of windows, and how would you do that? Like, what's the connection between form and function? And it caused me to look at every building that I saw from then on in a new way. Like, I saw things about it that I, because of that architecture class, I was able to say, aha, I know why that building is built that way. It's because they wanted to maximize the amount of sunlight that was coming through, right? Or they wanted to take advantage of some geometric, you know, feature. And it's opened up my eyes in ways that, so now if I go to I think I tell the story in the book. When I went to Harvard for grad school, I looked at a building and I had never seen this building before, but I could recognize it as the work of a particular architect. And that was amazing to me. Like, I was like, oh, that's clearly Henry Hobson Richardson, right? Or at least somebody who was inspired by H.H. Richardson. And that's, you know, that's the kind of experience I think we can have also in a math course, is to be able to say, oh, you know, I'm an engineer, and somebody says, how do you design a spaceship that has, you know, solar panels that fold up into small spaces to fit inside the ship, and then it unfolds when it's needed? You know, that's not very different than this needle turning problem, right? I've seen a problem like that before, right? And somehow you're like, whoa, this is kind of like that. Right. And suddenly that exploration that I did much earlier in my education now becomes relevant, because I'm trying to solve a particular problem and I have the insight to say this is like that. That's what we want from a math education.
Oh, and I guess that's a strong case for a core curriculum at a university, right? Like you probably wouldn't have chosen that class had you not been required to take any kind of gen ed class. But it also makes me wonder, you know, if you have to take up an art appreciation class, are there any math appreciation classes? As in, maybe for students that, you know, I'm not the math person, or, you know, I just want to, you know, teach English. But how wonderful it would be to have a math appreciation class, knowing you might not want to pursue it, but there's intrinsic value in learning more about mathematics.
Yeah, I would say that many of those classes do exist, but at the college level, often they're intro classes that are designed for non-majors to appreciate mathematics. You know, there could be, you know, focusing on great ideas in mathematics or ways that math intersects the world. They're less common at the high school level, and that's, you know, maybe a little bit unfortunate, but it's also a product of you know, many factors. And so being able to appreciate mathematics often, you know, in that way, we might turn to popular books that help help people see the beauty of math.
Let me switch gears a little bit and pick your brain on, you know, you talk a lot about math reasoning, right? And logic and problem solving. And in your book, you mentioned a few times, you know, just sitting there and really thinking until your brain hurt, right? And just trying to solve a problem. Has technology, I mean, the internet, smartphones, maybe even calculators, has that changed, maybe even damaged, I guess, some of our human ability to reason because we're so dependent on some of these devices? Have you seen that?
Yeah, I think I think the effect of technology has been too pronged, right? Like in some sense, there is some of the great good that technology allows us to do things that are routine and maybe not something you really want to spend your time on. It allows us to investigate things we might never be able to see before, you know, I've been able to see before. Right, because I can compute something, I can now explore something that I couldn't explore before. But as you said, there's also the way that it's made of passive rather than active and engaged people who are engaged in exploring things. Right, like you could sit in front of the TV and just veg and not actually have your brain do anything. Well, in a similar way, you could let a calculator do something for you or a computer do something for you, and spit out some result, which you just automatically trust. And you don't think about like, oh, what are the sources of error? Like, what are the ways that this thing could have gone wrong? Right. And what are the ways it could be telling me something that if I don't think about it, I'm going to miss. So I do think it has both its extreme pluses and extreme minuses. And we have to be wise about how we use technology. I think being over-reliant on it is not a good thing. And maybe an example of that is just thinking a little bit about the artificial intelligence revolution, which is very, very rapidly now changing the way that the kinds of tools that we have. How do we think responsibly about these technologies? I mean, that, of course, should be tackled in a good education as well. And math is no should not be a stranger to conversations about ethics and about what it is that we should be doing with math.
Well, let me ask you one question before we get to the last question that we asked all of our guests. And again, I'm just curious kind of on your thoughts. I read your chapter on permanence and your chapter on truth. And it's fascinating. And you talk a lot about, you know, there is this objective truth to math, right? There is this permanence to math that no matter what happens, we can always rely on that. We've heard similar statements, you know, about science, say, and you know what happened during COVID. And are you concerned that at some point your field, math, will be politicized, will succumb to some of the, ideological battle that we see so much in this country? Or do you feel like maybe that's the last kind of stronghold? No. We have our mathematics. We have our objective reality and our permanence there. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways it's already been being politicized in ways that I think are unfortunate. I mean, I think math has a certain objective truth to it that makes it attractive, right? It's kind of amazing that somebody separated from me by oceans or by culture or by time can come up and have exactly the same mathematical idea, right? There are people who prove this theorem, a certain theorem like the Pythagorean theorem, across multiple cultures, across multiple centuries, right? So there's something amazingly real about this thing that you could just think is a figment of people's imaginations, right? We do math in our minds. How is it they were able to access the same thing? That's the paraphrasing Einstein, right? Like, how it should be wondrous to us that somehow you could end up with thinking the same thoughts as somebody else. Now, on the other hand, there's also the experiences, the subjective experiences people have around mathematics, and that should not be discounted. And of course, often, you know, people are like, you know, math is completely objective, and other people are like, no, math is completely subjective. And I don't think it's, I think it's some of both, and it's not. I don't think we should be politicizing that piece of it, right? Like, your experience of mathematics is going to be very different from mine because of the environment you grew up in. Your ability to appreciate and enjoy it is strongly influenced by the people around you, and these are. If math is truly human, and if math involves growing in virtues like creativity and struggle and being able to wrestle with a problem for a long time to enjoy mathematics, we should worry that those experiences could be tainted by our environments. And so I would encourage us all to be a little more circumspect about the way we think about and talk about mathematics, and try to push it into one of these ideological buckets, right? I don't think it's fair to do that with education. You know, education is so nuanced, right? And I think we have to just be very clear-headed about what education is, what we're using it for, and not allow our ideological leanings to cloud our ability to look at an idea from multiple perspectives, which is also another virtue of mathematics, right? Looking at an idea from multiple perspectives brings a greater insight than just looking at it one way.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. I'm curious about this last question here, because like I said, we haven't had a mathematician on the show. So we always end the Anchored podcast by asking if there's been one book or one text, or I guess one math problem, which has been most impactful in your life, and why.
Are you specifically looking for a math book, or are you could it be any book?
Any.
Okay. Yeah. My absolute favorite book of all time is Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. And I love it for completely non-mathematical reasons. But I guess I love the broad sweeping explorations of human themes, like, you know, justice and love and war and peace and the redemptive thread that runs throughout the whole story. And I strongly commend that to all of you. I'll mention another book that may be more along, you know, that more be more related to this theme about education that I really enjoyed. It's a book I read recently that is written by Zena Hitz called Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of the Intellectual Life. And your listeners may enjoy that book.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, Zena Hitz she's on our CLT Board of Academic Advisors, and will actually be our keynote at our New Year's party here in Annapolis. And yes,
oh, great.
I recommend it is an incredible, incredible book. And so I'm glad you mentioned that. Well, this is absolutely delightful, Dr. Su. Again, we're here with Francis Su, who's the Benedictine Carver Professor of Mathematics at Harvey Mudd College. Dr. Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Anchored. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to leave a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. And remember to subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.